NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. At some point, many of us have encountered a wait to see a health professional. It can be annoying and frustrating and an inconvenience. But what if it turns out that the health problem is not minor, and that wait is the difference between life and death? Now, some families of veterans who waited for care from the Department of Veterans Affairs claim it was the difference between life and death.
I had a phone call from the hospital, VA, that we're here to set up a doctor's appointment for Mr. Thomas Breen. And my reply, I quote, was, "You're a little too late, he's dead, thank you very much."
That's Sally Alano, the daughter-in-law of one of 40 veterans who allegedly, who did die while pursuing care at the VA in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, about a dozen other VA healthcare facilities have come under scrutiny for alleged secret waiting lists. The undersecretary for health at the VA has resigned, and lawmakers and family members are demanding answers. We wanted to learn more about a story that has gained more and more national attention, so we've called Quill Lawrence, NPR's veterans correspondent. Quill, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let me start with that one important detail, and we'll work our way to the whole story. Is there evidence right now that the 40 deaths in Phoenix could have been prevented if veterans were seen sooner?
No, this is sort of one of the most misrepresented facts about this story. There is a whistleblower who says that 40 people may have died while on this waiting list, this separate waiting list that was kept off the books, and they received much delayed visits. There's no evidence that they died because they were waiting. In the case of Mr. Breen, he had advanced stage bladder cancer. There's no evidence yet that anyone on that list died because of those denied care
visits. So thank you for clarifying that, because I think it is an important detail. But is that how this whole issue came to light? I mean, that there was a whistleblower who had specific facts about a specific place, and then it kind of went from there?
Exactly. That was in Phoenix, and now there's an investigation going on there by the Inspector General of the VA. Since then, there have been whistleblowers at cities all over the country really coming forward and saying the same thing happens here. We have unofficial wait lists that sort of hide the fact of how long it takes us to see patients. And I think particularly in mental health care issues, there's concern that, for example, someone who's waiting and can't get to see a therapist might commit suicide while waiting. And with the high rate of suicide among veterans, that's a particular concern.
Talk to me a bit more, if you would, about how this whole issue is supposed to have worked. Like, there's not the allegation that people are deliberately not seeing patients or something like that. So this is not an issue with like fiscal malfeasance. What's the issue here? What happened here?
It's about cooking the stats. This has been a problem for years in the VA. For going back a dozen years, there are congressional inquiries about this and reports within the VA. And the issue of this 14-day period was a standard that was sent down saying, okay, everyone, you've got to see your patients within 14 days. They have to have an appointment 14 days from their request. Now, this couldn't be met across the country. Especially in the last 3 years, you've seen a 50% jump in the number of primary care visits and only a 9% jump in the number of primary care doctors. That's because of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. It's also because, say, Vietnam veterans are hitting the age where they need a lot more medical care. And so essentially what was happening seems pretty much across the country is people who wanted to look good in their stats were cooking the books, and they were sending in or gaming the system in ways. And there's internal communication within the VA saying, stop gaming the system. 2 years ago, there was a memo sent out saying you have to stop changing these around to make you look like you're making these stats when you're not.
Yeah, the agency was heavily criticized previously for an enormous backlog. Is that the same issue, or is one a response to the other?
No, it's really easy to confuse those two. Yeah. So this is the wait times problem, the long wait times for people to get access to the medical care. The backlog, commonly referred to, is the wait for people to get a disability rating. They come home from Iraq or Afghanistan. They've got ringing in their ears from explosions. They've got a bad back and bad knees, like every veteran I've ever spoken with, from carrying around heavy gear and running around combat zones. And so they apply to the VA and say, I'm disabled. I need a 50% disability rating, and then they send it in. And very often they wait and wait. What happened at the same time all of these vets were coming back into the system, VA Secretary Eric Shinseki made a few rulings that added an enormous number of people to his lists. Agent Orange, people from Vietnam who had been claiming that they had illnesses related to the herbicide Agent Orange. For years, they'd been fighting with the VA saying, I have cancer because I was sprayed with Agent Orange. Finally, Secretary Shinseki just said, if you were in Vietnam while Agent Orange was being used and you have one of these dozen conditions, we're just going to say you've got it because of Agent Orange. And he added a huge number of backlog claims to his own list then. He also invited a lot of people in who have PTSD and just said, if you were in combat and you've got PTSD now, we're just going to go out on a limb and say it's because of the combat. We're going to say that's service-connected. So he really ruined his own bottom line in terms of clearing numbers of people in the backlog several years ago. So in the last year, that has been reduced from its high point of 600,000 vets who were waiting more than a few months to get their rating. It's now down to under 300,000 who are waiting. They say they're going to finish this up within a year, that they'll clear the backlog completely.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about investigations into the so-called gaming strategies to cover up delays in veterans' health care. Our guest is Quil Lawrence, NPR's veterans correspondent. He's walking us through this story. Let's talk about Eric Shinseki for a minute. He's a retired four-star general. He's the secretary of this agency. Has he been well-respected to this point, or has it been a rocky issue all along, first dealing with the backlog and then with the additional demands for care and so forth?
So Eric Shinseki is a disabled vet himself. Even the people who've called for him to resign have never questioned his integrity. And there was there were a lot of calls for him to resign last year about the backlog issue. Now they've made a lot of progress on it. In this case, it was kind of a surprise. When this wait times scandal started to break, there were criticisms from some people on the Hill who had already called for his resignation in the past. But then one of the largest American veteran service organization, the American Legion, came out in what was a surprise announcement and called on Eric Shinseki and his two deputies to resign. And then since then, there has been a string of other healthcare facilities saying that we also had this problem cooking the books, and different people are on the fence waiting to see the results of this investigation before they'll pass judgment on Shinseki. Other veterans groups have come out strongly in favor, and they'll say he's reduced veterans homelessness, he has brought down the backlog now, and they respect his leadership. Others will say, well, we're not thrilled with Shinseki, particularly with his public communication, but we think it would take a new secretary so long to get up to speed that we think he should stay.
Let me just play an exchange from there was a hearing last Thursday before the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. And this is an exchange between Senator Patty Murray of Washington and the secretary. Of course, she's a Democrat. We'll play it.
Okay. The standard practice at the VA seems to be to hide the truth in order to look good. And I want to know how you're going to get your medical directors and your network leaders to tell you when they have a problem, rather than pursuing these secret lists and playing games with these wait times.
Well, Senator, if there's anything that gets me angrier than just hearing allegations is to hear you tell me that we have folks that can't be truthful because they think the system doesn't allow it.
Well, what about that? I mean, is there the implication here that this whole issue is a reflection of his management style, or a broader cultural problem at the agency where you can't tell the truth, or that the problems, real problems, somehow don't surface until it's too late? What's the thought here?
This issue was there long before Shinseki, but he's now been in office almost 6 years, so it's really on him now to do something about it. He's tried. There are many, many stories about trying to fix the bureaucracy and within the VA. And in fact, there's a bill coming out of the House this week to give the secretary the power to more easily fire people. He would defend his record and did in that Senate hearing, saying that they have relieved about 3,000 people from their jobs last year for performance issues, but then they couldn't really answer the question about whether those people were fired or maybe they were moved to a different post or they were demoted. It's notoriously difficult to fire people within this vast healthcare system that is the VA.
So finally, we have about a minute and a left, Quill, and thanks for bringing us up to date on this. I know that many people will have been hearing pieces of the story, so thanks for bringing it all together for us. But naturally, people are horrified when they hear of something like this. I mean, particularly people who have served the country and have been injured or possibly as a result of that, and they find out that they're not getting the care that they should have. But as an independent healthcare system, how does the VA rank? I mean, we keep hearing that there are surveys that show that veterans overall are generally happy with the care that they receive. So what's the big picture here?
Well, in that same hearing, it was pointed out that medical errors within the healthcare system outside the VA is one of the leading causes of death in the United States. So it sort of made the point that the VA healthcare system can be riddled with errors and problems, especially getting access. Once people get the care, they're generally very, very satisfied with it. And even Shinseki's critics last week said that they like the care. They want vets to trust the VA to go in and get the care. But it may just be that it can be riddled with errors and still be one of the best healthcare systems in America. And it may the counter to that is some people say, well, our vets should have better than that. They shouldn't have to stand for these errors, even if this is relatively good compared to healthcare in America in general.
Quill Lawrence is NPR's veterans correspondent. He was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York City. Quill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Just ahead, your grad might be coming into a decent stash of cash in all those cards from the relatives, and that can be a good thing or not.
The younger they are, the more likely they're going to use it on something kind of dumb.
We ask one of our regular Money Coach contributors for advice on how much to give and how that money can be used to set good habits for the future. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
We came up short of our goals during the last two radio pledge drives. That's added some extra urgency to our fiscal end-of-year fundraising. Fortunately, two friends of WILL want to jumpstart our June fundraising with the single biggest challenge gift in our history. They will donate $40,000 if other friends of WILL contribute $20,000 on Monday, June 2nd. Can you help? For more information or to make your June jumpstart gift, go to will.illinois.edu/junejumpstart.
Even after 100 years, the legacy of the First World War lives on in much of Europe.
Some of the problems associated with World War I are still there in the Balkans today.
Touring the sites of World War I in the former Yugoslavia and in Britain. Plus, Jane and Michael Stern share what their favorite road food cooks in the South tell them when they ask for their secret ingredient.
The answer to that is we cook it just right.
It's all on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. So we have an update on a story we've been following. And at this point, Donald Sterling probably doesn't need an introduction. But just in case, he is the owner of the NBA team, the LA Clippers. And he was caught on tape making racist remarks about African-Americans. He's also been sued in the past and settled complaints saying he discriminated against blacks and Latinos in renting properties that he owned. The NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, said the league would take steps to remove Donald Sterling from ownership once those remarks were confirmed to be his, and now Commissioner Silver has made good on that threat. The NBA has made a formal move to terminate Donald Sterling's ownership interest because, quote, Mr. Sterling's actions and positions significantly undermine the NBA's efforts to promote diversity and inclusion and, quote, damage the NBA's relationship with its fans, unquote. We wanted to hear more, so we've called Pablo Torre, senior writer at ESPN. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Pablo, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle, as always.
So this was an expected move here. What's the next step? What has to happen now?
Right. So the league has initiated its charge to terminate Donald Sterling's ownership of the Clippers. And this is a month after the tape was released, which fits within the NBA's kind of self-appointed sense of judiciousness and swiftness. And so right now, that charge means that on May 27th, Donald Sterling will stand before, or once he gets his charge in, will stand before the NBA Board of Governors on June 3rd. Sterling has until May 27th to respond. And so at this point, what he's doing is assessing whether he wants to respond, which would open up another can of worms if he doesn't. But also he has to now appeal to his fellow owners, to appeal to their sense of judiciousness in order to convince them that, in fact, they don't want to oust him because three-quarters of the Board of Governors would be required to complete that termination.
Who presides over this? And are there rules of conduct and similar to a judicial hearing? I mean, who's the judge?
Yeah, it's not quite a judicial hearing, but it's Adam Silver and the Board of Governors and the NBA executive structure. And this is, it's a good question because the NBA is far more of an idiosyncratic kind of fraternity slash country club slash private institution and not quite like any sort of federally run business or institution. It's not like a college or a state institution where you can appeal to a sense of due process. In fact, one of the conversations that's been ongoing in the Donald Sterling saga is this NBA constitution, which was in fact secret to the public until this case. That's how opaque it was, and it was opaque on purpose. It was this thing that was private and sort of the membership governed its own. But we know in that constitution that due process isn't the same thing. The owners, when they agree to buy into the NBA, they agree that the NBA is his binding authority. They actually waive their right to sue. Now, Donald Sterling can certainly challenge that on other judicial grounds, but that's sort of the standard. And there are all these articles in that constitution which say you may not engage in unethical conduct and you cannot damage the NBA, which is one thing that the NBA is certainly talking about in that charge. But there's another thing where Donald Sterling has refused to pay the $2.5 million fine, which had come out previously, and that violates, in fact, another article, Article 13C, where you talk about how failure to pay your debts to the NBA is explicitly grounds for termination. So Donald Sterling has been digging himself a fairly sizable hole.
It's been reported by SportsIllustrated.com that the attorney for Donald Sterling has asked for more time. He wanted 3 months to respond instead of the couple of weeks till the end of the month that the commissioner has laid out. And he's also refusing to pay the fine. Is all of that true?
Yeah, that's what's been reported so far. And all of this, again, adds up to this picture of Donald Sterling, who we already knew to be, a guy who loved litigation. He's a lawyer. But the fact that he is being difficult about the structure and the process here is not endearing him to the NBA at all, certainly not. And so when the owners are looking at this guy, you know, I think Donald Sterling in some sense realizes, look, he's been rejected summarily by the marketplace of ideas in the American public at large. And I think he senses that the NBA owners are pretty unanimous in the direction they're going to go. And so he's fighting and scrapping for every edge that he can. But in terms of convincing these owners, none of that is going to endear them to him.
To that end, Donald Sterling did do an extensive interview with CNN's Anderson Cooper. And it seems as though he further offended not just fans and individuals, but the league. For example, he by making comments about the basketball great and the entrepreneur Magic Johnson has not really done much to support the African-American community, and he's made disparaging comments about his HIV status, for which Commissioner Adam Silver apologized on behalf of the league. So it's hard for me to understand what his strategy is at some point, right? I mean,
it's totally indecipherable. I mean, all of the things he said publicly will be used against him at this hearing and in the process of terminating his ownership, because all of those comments about further criticizing minorities, further showing himself to be insensitive at best, his greatest tactical error, in quite honestly, Michelle, might be going after Magic Johnson, this guy who is so beloved and represents so many positive things, and yet he keeps on attacking him, which further offends the NBA, further offends the public, further divorces him from any reality that the public can sympathize with. So it's insensitivity towards a man in particular, but also just the general situation of African Americans who comprise the NBA as in terms of employees and also fans. I mean, all of this stuff is an indecipherable PR strategy. And one of the things that you could tell from that interview, he didn't even know that Anderson Cooper was openly gay. Like, he had not been coached for that interview, or if he had, he had willfully neglected it for some reason. All of that adds up to a picture of Donald Sterling, who is somebody you do not want to be an owner in your league.
Have the other owners, you mentioned that they have to have a supermajority. Three-quarters of the owners have to agree to terminate his ownership interest. Has there been any indication of where they're going on this?
Yeah, the thinking is that Adam Silver, in all of his savvy and a legal mind himself and the protege of David Stern, he would not have moved as swiftly and as clearly as he has about this if he didn't have a full majority. People are expecting this to be a clean sweep. The owners seem to be on the same page. And that's something that, you know, you wonder if this were ever to be publicly leaked, the voting, right? You would not want to be one of the owners who supported him. And that media pressure, at the very least, is a significant factor.
I was going to ask you about that. That was going to be my final question. Is there generally a public consensus around this? I mean, you have to note that I made pains to say who Donald Sterling is and debated whether that was even necessary, because the story seems to have just kind of completely dominated public consciousness, at least for people who are interested in sports. But I mean, everybody from Secretary of State John Kerry to Justin Timberlake to the president,
to Eric Holder, to everybody has weighed in, right?
Yeah, have kind of had something to say about this. It's more than a meme. So you're saying that you feel that the owners would be under a lot of pressure if they didn't.
Exactly. And it feels like they're totally on the same page. And one of the things that was interesting to track was you had owners early on in this saga voicing kind of these philosophical critiques. Mark Cuban was talking about, you know, the right of an owner to say what's in his home, you know, privately and have that used against him is a slippery slope. But all of that very quickly evaporated. Cuban did a complete 180, completely reneged on that philosophical critique, which is worth discussing.
Why is that? Yeah.
And I think it was because the public pressure became so unanimous that the conversation around Donald Sterling became so radioactive. You know, there is an intelligent, sophisticated conversation to have about public versus private. But one of the things that Donald Sterling established is he has sort of this, as one of my colleagues put it, this sort of lifetime achievement award for racism thing, where everybody understands who he is and what his history is. And even if it's not being explicitly brought up right now, everybody's sensitive to who this man has been for so long that they feel it's very dangerous to use him as a hill you might want to die on, so to speak, philosophically.
That was ESPN senior writer Pablo Torre joining us from our bureau in New York. Pablo, thanks so much for keeping us up to date on this.
Thank you, Michelle.
Let's turn now to matters of personal finance. Graduation season is here, and many newly minted graduates are hoping that there's more in those cards than the well wishes of aunts, uncles, and godparents. Yes, we're talking money. There's likely to be a $20 bill or two for high school grads, and perhaps some more serious cash for those who are finishing college or graduate school. But before you go and throw down on some new audio equipment, or dare we say it, shoes, we thought we'd like to ask our money coach, Luis Barajas, for some tips on what graduates should do with that windfall. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
So first, let's talk about the givers, and then we'll talk about the receivers. How about that? So
Okay. Do
you have a rule of thumb for how much money you think it's wise to give to a high school graduate and then a college graduate?
Yeah, on giving, I actually don't have a rule of thumb. My parents, my dad in particular, gives my daughters money all the time. And I don't know if he's trying to buy their affection or he's just, you know, giving them lots of money. But it just depends on each parent and each grandparent or relatives based on how well they're off and how much they're willing to give and how great the students have done in school and their grades.
So let's then talk about the students. Let's talk about high school students. Let's say, do you have any general advice for what to do? Because you can imagine where a kid would say, you know, I've worked hard. You know, this is my money. I should get to do whatever I want. You know, go on a beach trip or blow it on shoes. What would you say to that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Once they've graduated from high school and they've applied for college and getting ready to go in there, it's becoming a very competitive environment out there for people. And when they're going to college, maybe they might want to think about using the money that they've received instead into buying what I call tools to make them more competitive in college, or maybe upgrading their laptop or using something that they're going to be using towards college to become better students.
If the student is in high school and is going to college, well, even if they aren't, I mean, if they don't have a savings account or a checking account, is that the first thing that they should do?
Absolutely. What happens is we need to teach every child that there's different purposes for money. Some of it is for having fun and spending it, obviously, but you've got to take a certain portion of it and save it for the future. Use it, because sometimes we'll see some kids early in the first year of college who already have credit card debt, and we have to show them that they've got to pay down that debt. But the first thing I have them do, if they haven't done it so far, is open up a savings account.
So let's talk college graduates now. Their financial needs might be completely different than, you know, a high school student. They might be, what, moving into a first apartment, moving to another city. Any sort of basic advice for that new college graduate?
Right. Obviously, outside of the emergency fund and paying the credit card debts and student loans, you know, one of the things that I've told them, if they've graduated from college and they're going to go into the workforce, is what about buying your first professional wardrobe? For a gentleman, it might be his first suit. For a woman, it might be her first professional dress for interviewing. You know, when I went to UCLA, all I owned was bear wear. That's all I could afford at the time. I didn't have a suit. I didn't own a tie. And sometimes we need to use some of that money to invest in ourselves.
What about starting off a retirement fund early? I know that may sound crazy to a new college grad, but what about, you know, opening up an IRA or something like that? Do you think that's a good idea or not?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, my daughter's graduating from college this year, and I've encouraged her to open up a Roth IRA this year. That's a wonderful thing as well. You know, another thing, Michelle, is that I've actually asked students if they've never traveled, for example, if they've come sometimes from areas of poverty, they can use that money to do some traveling. I've encouraged some of the kids to use some of their money that they've received from graduation to take a trip to Europe with other students and really understand how the world's working. I think that's sometimes a good investment that we don't even think about.
Do you feel that students should discuss this with their parents? I mean, I know that in some families that I've known, for example, when kids get a big financial gift, they're expected to turn it over to their parents to kind of repay them. Other people would just find that crazy. They'd say, well, no, I mean, that's the whole point of giving the student the money or the kid the money so that they can learn how to use it, even if they wind up making mistakes. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, it just depends on the family and how well-to-do the family is or how they... But when somebody gives you a gift, it's for you. It's not to as an obligation to pay back. My feeling is that it's your money. You are supposed to do what you want to. If you really want to help your family back out, then that's fine. But again, the purpose is to find its highest and best use. And if we can teach kids from an early age to do that, then they're going to have a much better financial future.
I liked what you said there. Can you just say that again? So is that like the first thing you should have? You should take that money and say, what's the highest and best use of this? Is that what you do whenever you get a lump sum of money for whatever reason?
Absolutely. Whenever I sit down with anyone and we find what is called found money or windfalls, we'll always ask them, what's your highest and best use for this money? Is it for marriage counseling? If it's for older people? If it's for college students? Is it paying down your debt? Is it investing in yourself? How can you maximize the value of the money that you've received to make you a better person or to do something for yourself or for others? And again, that's just the training ground to get your mindset in the proper way for getting more money when you start earning more in the future.
What if you get a small amount, like a $100, for example, and, you know, you, I think, and other financial advisors have said, it's like if you get some crazy windfall, like a lottery payout or something like that, sometimes it's best to set a portion aside and to blow it just so you can kind of take the steam out of it, right? Do you recommend that for kids, or do you think No, no, it's really best to try to be as disciplined as possible, no matter how much you have.
No, actually, it's the opposite. When we set goals, and for example, a child has had trouble passing their math classes, and all of a sudden they've passed algebra, they've graduated from high school, or they've graduated from college, and it was a huge accomplishment. You need to focus on sometimes celebrating. We forget to celebrate our victories. And so it's a great thing, because once we celebrate that, then we can set another bigger goal. It might be the child not wanting to go and getting a master's degree or getting a job in another country. And again, it's wonderful to use money to help celebrate. And also an important thing is to celebrate with others.
What I think I hear you saying is it doesn't have to be something that you hold in your hand. It doesn't have to be a thing. It can be an experience, and that you should see that as equally valuable if that's something that would improve your life, right?
Well, academic research tells us that sometimes the highest and best use of money, and for money to make you really happy and to enjoy memories down the future, is to be used for experiences. And I truly believe that. And that, to me, is something that's a foundational part of creating a really successful financial future.
Can I put you on the spot for a minute?
Sure.
What's the dumbest thing you ever did with a windfall, and what's the best thing you ever did with a windfall?
The best thing that I've ever done for windfall, I guess, is taken a leap of faith to start my own business, to start my own firm, because it really took a lot of money to do that at the beginning. The dumbest thing I've ever done was blow it on like an expensive watch. I think I read one of those motivational books that said a man must have a nice watch and nice shoes, right? So I said, okay, so I'll just buy myself a nice professional watch that ended up costing more money than I thought it was going to be. So that was a dumb thing.
And now you use your phone to keep track of the time, right?
Yeah, actually, I do. Yeah, funny enough, right?
Luis Barajas is an author and personal finance counselor. He joined us from Irvine, California. Luis, thanks so much for joining us.
Always my pleasure, Michelle.
Coming up, if your child's dinner preferences start at crackers and end at chicken nuggets, you might have a picky eater on your hands. But some parents say those habits can be broken, and it is well worth the effort.
If you teach your kids to cook now, they'll be making you dinner later.
Now do we have your attention? Stick around for a parenting panel on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from John and Catherine Debs in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
Edward St. Aubin just won Britain's only literary award for comic fiction for his new novel, Satirizing Literary Awards. Aubin is also the author of 5 semi-autobiographical novels about coming of age in a monstrous aristocratic family. Those books are social satires, but they're filled with pain. Edward St. Aubin joins us on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Tune in to WILL-TV for the 25th anniversary broadcast of the National Memorial Day Concert. Hosted by acclaimed actors Joe Mantegna and Gary Sinise, the concert is a night of remembrance honoring the service and sacrifice of our men and women in uniform. They're joined by an all-star lineup in performance with the National Symphony Orchestra on the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol. Watch the National Memorial Day Concert, Sunday night at 7 on WILL-TV.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, we thought we'd get some advice about food. And we were thinking about this because as we head into summer, parents may be taking kids to more picnics and cookouts and family reunions. And many are dreading that moment when your family friend or your mother-in-law places a carefully prepared plate of home cooking in front of your children, and they go, "Ew, I'm not eating that." Many parents know the type. They only want the chicken nuggets or hamburgers or pizza or anything else will bring an upturned nose, even some tears. But our panel says you can end the tyranny of the tears about food. You can enjoy those family meals instead of dreading them, even with those so-called picky eaters. So with us now to talk about this, Sally Sampson. She's founder of Chop Chop, an organization that encourages children to cook. She's also a mom of two. Welcome, Sally.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Frederick Douglass Opie is a food historian at Babson College, also a dad of two. Frederick Douglass Opie, welcome back to you. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for the invitation. And hello, Sally.
Hi, how are you?
And also with us, Anupi Singla. She's a cookbook author and a mom of two. Anupi, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
So Sally, let me start with you because you're kind of like super nanny for food. You recently spent 6 weeks with a family who have four-year-old twins to try to get them to be less picky, and you wrote about that experience for the New York Times, and you say that picky eating is often about control. Tell us about that.
Well, I think kids often control the meal and therefore the parents. So they get the parents to sort of jump up all the time and cater to them. And if somebody's catering to you, you don't have a lot of reason to stop. So I think it really is about control.
Frederick, you were telling us that, you know, I was thinking about like the old school way of dealing with this, since you're like our historian here, how back in the day, I think it was not at all uncommon for people to say, you know, you will eat it and you will sit there all night. I have friends who were actually literally forced to sit at the dinner table all night if they didn't clean their plates. I don't know about, you know, I'm not disclosing who this may have happened to, but I don't know. Those are some, but that kind of old school attitude toward food. I mean, where do you think it came from, and why do you think that? You'd hear very little about that now.
Where did it come from? There's so many things in our food traditions and cultures that we don't have the answer to. You know, a lot of these are kind of family traditions and habits and quirks, to be honest with you. But, you know, every family's different, and I think it is about balance. It's certainly, you know, I was thinking about, you know, our conversation, and I'm a 50-plus dad, so I have an 8- and 11-year-old, and I tend to be much more old school than the contemporary, you know, to the parents of my children's classmates. So if you come to my house, it's going to be one experience. My kids go to another house, it's a lot more laissez-faire, put it that way.
Do you think that's why I think that there's more variation on this, because people don't like how they were necessarily raised around food and they want to be more loosey-goosey about it? Do you think that that's kind of part of it? People are throwing out the old ways, but they don't know what they want to replace it with.
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of what I would call cooks in the kitchen when it comes to, you know, how do you raise your kids and, you know, how do you get your kids to eat is one of those. But I do agree with Sally. This whole idea of catering to the kids to the point of exhaustion, I think this makes for a very difficult way to get them, to train them up in some good eating habits. And my philosophy with my kids is, first of all, is I cook with them, and I think they have a better sense of it. Also garden with them that have a better sense of what they're eating. So my kids are much more user-friendly when it comes to things like vegetables.
Good. I want to hear some practical advice from each of you in a minute, but Anupi, I want to hear from you first. You were saying you think we should actually do away with the phrase picky eater. Tell me why.
Yeah, I really do. I hear a lot of my kids' friends coming to my house, actually. They come to my house and they'll announce to me, you know, I'm a picky eater. I only eat white foods. I only eat this. I only eat that. And I always say to them, hey, guys, let's not label ourselves. And so I think what's happening is often parents are out there saying this stuff, their kids are picking up on it, and thus they are using it as a way to go ahead and not eat certain things, giving themselves an out. The other part of it is, I believe, that we're all human beings that are evolving, even as adults, in terms of what we like and what we don't like. I mean, you could say, and I write about this on my blog, Chicago and His Apple Pie, which is part of the Chicago Now family. And I talked about how my kids, you could almost say they're picky eaters. They eat every fresh vegetable vegetable or fruit out there. However, my older one won't eat sauces. My little one eats every sauce you give her. My older one will only eat fresh food. I mean, I've spoiled her just cooking at home. I write cookbooks, so obviously we do a lot of that. But she'll go somewhere and they'll say, nope, we don't eat this chicken, or we don't eat something prepped this way. They don't even eat Indian food in certain Indian restaurants because they get it a certain way at home. Is that picky? Yeah, maybe in some ways it is. So let's get rid of that picky eater sort of term. And let's just say, look, there's some days when they will eat certain things, some days when they won't. Mm. And you have to just kind of keep throwing it at them and continue to work at it. It's a lot of work.
I'm wondering what Professor Frederick Douglass Opie says when kids come to his house and say, I only eat white food. I'm just kind of awaiting the answer. But what do you say when kids come over? Because that peer pressure is part of it, isn't it? Is it that idea that all the kids eat this, so therefore I have to eat that? I mean,
it's a lot like coaching. I mean, I see kids do or interact with their parents who I coach that they don't do that with me. And when you come in my door, it's, you know, I will be flexible, but there's some things we just don't play in my house. And I thinking about your question about how did this start, a lot of what we talk about is a class dimension, because the bottom line is poor folks who do not get a regular meal, they don't have the option of being picky. That's a middle and upper class option.
All right. Well, having said that, let's talk about some practical advice. Sally, why don't you start? Because you started with this, you wrote this piece about working with these kids. How do you start when you want to break that cycle in your own home?
Well, what we did with the 4-year-olds was the parents sat down with them and said, from now on, we're having one dinner. This is it. And they got the kids to participate. So the kids, they took them to the grocery store and said, we're going to have the idea is that you start where the kids are, basically. But in this case, the parents said, we're going to have turkey burgers tonight. So that was kind of exciting to the kids. And they said to one twin, you can pick any fruit you want. And they said to the other one, you can pick any vegetable you want. The kids were so excited to be choosing. And then they went home, and the idea was that they were going to surprise mommy with dinner. So they did all this with the dad, and the kids, just the process of cooking it, induced them to participate fully, you know, by just every piece of it. And they did taste things. I will say that I think the less of a big deal you make of the whole thing, the better. Like, you don't say to kids, you have to try something, or aren't you terrific because you tried it? Very low key, so that it's sort of it's just what we do.
Interesting. To that point, if you're just joining us, we're talking about, picky eaters, a term that some feel should be banned. We're talking about that. For people who still use that term, we're talking about how to break that cycle of, you know, kids controlling your dinner table. So Fred, why don't you pick up the thread there? It's interesting because you do make an interesting point that a lot of people will find that their kids won't eat green beans in their house, but then they go over to the neighbor's house and they say, well, what'd you have for dinner? Green beans. They were delicious. And you're like, what? You know, what are you doing? So, Fred, what about you?
One of the things that I've learned from my two children, they're 11 and 8, boy and girl, is that they will tell you the real deal if your food is good. So you may think you can cook, but when you put it in front of those kids, they'll tell you. I mean, you talk about food critics. So one of the things I've learned with my kids is small portions. I want to give them enough to tease them to say, I like this, I want more. That's the best compliment to me as a cook. So I give them small portions, and then aesthetics. It's got to be pretty. If it's not pretty, they check out. I've noticed that with both my kids. So I try, you know, I watch these cooking shows and see how people, you know, present their food, and I really embrace that in how I cook. But at the same time, I also give them buy-in when we go to the store. You know, this is what we're getting, this is what we're talking about, this is what we're going to do. And then there's also a great healthy, now listen to me, healthy dessert is a great bribe to get through some of those tough moments, like my chicken bog the other day, which my son, he locked in. That was it. He wasn't eating chicken bog. But, you know, that having that dessert there on the side of the table, you know, that's great leverage.
And Hoopy, what about you? You, in fact, just to remind people who may not be familiar with your work, because you've been with us a number of times before, you actually changed careers in part because you wanted to change your own family's eating habits. I mean, you were a TV newscaster, and then you kind of, that's part of what the motivation was for moving around into food. So what would you recommend?
That's right. I came home and I realized, you know what, if I didn't do it and I didn't take ownership of it, nobody in my household was going to do that. My husband travels Monday through Friday. He's not a reporter, so he does make money. He made more than I did at the time, so that was an easy call. And we have grandparents. The kids have grandparents that don't necessarily live close, so it was up to me. And I decided, especially my background as a reporter and a writer and all of this, to really use education as a way to get these kids to understand why food is good. No, we do not count calories. We don't talk about that aspect of it. We haven't needed to do that with our kids. But it's really more about educating them on minerals, vitamins, why these foods are good. So I would keep this gigantic food encyclopedia by my table, and we would sit down and eat. We would eat a sweet potato, and then we'd have one kid look up, what is sweet potato? Why is it good for us? What else can we do with it? And they would help with cooking it. And it's, again, it's a lot of work, but it was really worthwhile. And then they would learn why they would eat that sweet potato. Also, in terms of the cereals, a lot of these kids are eating very sugar-packed cereals. I would always have my kids take a look at the label and see how much cereal, and they know what a big number is, they know what a small number is. So they would be able to compare, and they'd say, okay, well, that big number is a very sometimes maybe rare sort of food treat we get. It's almost like a dessert, but this cereal that has less sugar in it is one that we can eat on a daily basis. So it's always sometimes foods, always foods, and the never things are, you know, the smoking and the drugs. So I really say that I bring things in. You know, I never completely ban things because I don't want to have that sort of reputation with my kids. But I want them to be able to kind of make those decisions on their own. And I have to say, Michelle, when they go out with their friends, they're the ones, when it's ice cream at the end of the day, they look at me and I go, okay, you want an ice cream and all your friends are getting it? Well, what was your day like? Did you have treats before? And like, yeah, we did, Mom. We're going to take a pass. They actually say that to me because I've taught them why they need to say that.
So Sally, I want to loop back to something that Fred talked about earlier, which is the whole class dimension of this, which is that I think it's great when people can take 2 4-year-olds to the grocery store and not lose their minds. I think that's, as a twin parent myself, I'm thinking, you know, that would have been. But but for people who don't have the kinds of jobs where they can take 2 hours at the grocery store, for people who are possibly single parents and have to get a lot done, have to get that food on the table in kind of a minimum amount of time, I mean, how do you recommend working on this? I mean, you can understand why people fall into the chicken nuggets. And I mean, even our First Lady, Michelle Obama, has talked about the fact that, you know, back when her husband, now the president, was at the state, was serving in the state legislature, was away from home a lot, and she's trying to manage sports practices and her own job and their lives and homework and all that. You could fall into the food in a sack that you can throw in to the oven quickly. Sally, so thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, it's actually not true that it's cheaper to eat junk than it is to cook fresh food. It really isn't. But you can make a sandwich. You can do non-cooking things. You can grab carrots. I mean, you can do very, very small steps, which I think is the way to start. So even putting aside the buying the junk food, let's say you're making, let's say it's a sandwich. You can say to a kid, do you want to put this on it or this on it? Do you want to set the table? Just all those little steps. But back to what you asked, I think
it wasn't so much the money issue as the time issue.
Simple food doesn't take much time. People forget about, you have to get to the fast food place and you have to order and wait. And if you're making really, I mean, even if you think about how long it takes to make a burger takes 10 minutes from start to finish. And but I do agree that picky eating does not exist in poor families. And it didn't exist until, I mean, not, it didn't never exist, but it didn't exist in the way that it does in this generation. And I think it's, generally speaking, a parenting issue rather than a taste issue. I think it's parents who don't want to create rules and regulations for their kids. I know that's a very unpopular thing to say, but I really do believe at the end of the day it's that. Also, I do agree that the term picky eating is not a great one in spite of the fact that I'm using it. But I don't think picky eating is not liking things. I think you can not like certain foods and not be a picky eater. To me, a picky eater is somebody who just says, I'm not going to eat this whole class of food. I'm not going to taste it. It's just this sort of turning off.
Final. I see your point. So, Fred, final thought here. We have about a minute and a half left, and what you and Anupi can share. Final thought. I've heard a lot from each of you about choice. Giving some choice seems to be a common theme with all of you. Giving the kids some choice and role in preparation. But Fred, can you do that and still make it pretty as you were telling us?
You can. You can. And you know, fortunately, at Babson College, where I work, we have a garden, you know, behind my office. And we live close enough to campus that my children love. My daughters always ask me, can we go check the strawberries? Are they ripe? And they love to pick food from the garden, including the herbs, and come home and incorporate them into whatever they're eating. So I think that's important. You know, I think it's also important because I'm the only guy, you know, in this segment, is that the people understand I'm the cook in the house by choice. That was my prenup. Are you comfortable with me cooking because I want to do it? So I'm not just talking theoretically. I do think Sally is right. It's a lot about prep. A lot of the cooking that I do is on the weekend, and I'm prepping things, whether it's marinating something that I'm then going to cook on Tuesday or Wednesday. So a lot of it is prep. A lot of it's just planning ahead and thinking about what you're actually going to choose. And I also do cook by what's on sale when I go to the grocery market, not based on some menu that my kids have asked for.
All right. Anupi, final thought from you. Has to be brief.
Well, real quick, I'd almost say starve your kids, but in kind of a funny, humorous way. You don't have to feed them every minute of the day. I see moms giving their kids all of these, you know, dry cereals and all of this in between meals. How about three solid meals, a few snacks, but make them healthy snacks? These kids are full already. Why are they going to sit down to a meal if they've already eaten three times before they get to dinner?
So lose the granola bars.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Anupi Singla is a cookbook author and a mom of two. She was with us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Sally Sampson is founder of Chop Chop. That's an organization that encourages children to cook, children and families, I should say. She's a mom of two. She was with us from NPR West in Culver City, California. And Frederick Douglass Opie is a food historian at Babson College and a father of two. He's with us from Boston. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.